Welcome to the Product Podcast by Product School. Here's a preview of today's talk.
So, really, when we think about what an enterprise customer is, you know, going through a couple examples, more obvious ones, Walmart is the biggest employer in the United States. It's a pretty well-known brand name, both here and across the world. And so this is an example of someone that is just so big, you know, everyone kind of knows them. You know, when we talk about brands, think about something like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is a brand that is known, again, worldwide. But using these examples and going off of what I was talking about earlier, you know, when Checker was, you know, early on in its, you know, life cycle, we were able to work with Uber. And early on for Uber, it's hard to imagine now, but Uber was not a well-known name. They were kind of like this interesting taxi ordering service. And the reason Checker succeeded was because we were able to identify that Uber was going to be one of those companies that would grow as time goes on.
In this podcast, we teach our listeners valuable lessons about product management and transform them into thinking like a product manager. We teach product management, coding, data analytics, and blockchain in 14 campuses worldwide, including San Francisco, New York, and Seattle. You can find more information at productschool.com. Join our Slack community of 25,000 professionals to network and stay tuned for our upcoming events.
Well, thank you guys. I'm super excited to be speaking here at Product School. I was fortunate enough to get a lot of training and mentorship earlier in my career, and I'm hoping I can pass on some of the little knowledge that I've gained to all of you. So today in the talk, I know the event title is more about B2B versus B2C product management, and I will cover that a little bit, but really the focus for me for this presentation is to talk about enterprise product management, what that means, you know, and we'll go through a lot of stuff about defining exactly what enterprise means, and really defining what an enterprise PM is, and we will compare kind of B2B and B2C. And in this presentation, I'll try and draw upon some of the experiences that I've had to really help you guys understand what it's like to be an enterprise or a B2B product manager and how to sort of operate in those situations for the future. So to start off, a little bit about me. I worked at Microsoft as I started my career. I was fortunate enough to work during a very interesting time at the company. I was on the Windows Developer Platform team. I was on the team that actually brought the Bash shell to Windows. If you guys have heard of that, I actually didn't work on that feature. I would love to claim to, but it was actually my manager along with a bunch of other people across the developer platform organization. So that was really exciting. And I did give a talk at the Build conference, Microsoft's sort of flagship developer conference, about not the Bash shell, but about a project I was working on around user automation testing. But most recently, I am working at Checker. Checker is a really awesome company that does background checks for a lot of the on-demand companies that you probably use a lot. So Uber, Lyft, Postmates, Grubhub, a lot of these companies, because of the way we've structured our product and support technology and API-first companies, we've been able to be successful in this space, and we're currently moving into more traditional enterprises. So it's been a really cool journey for me there the past couple of years, seeing our transition from, you know, kind of a smaller, scrappy startup to try to be a more legacy player in this really outdated industry of background checks. You know, goes without saying, I grew up in the Bay Area. I'm a huge fan of Bay Area sports, 49ers and Warriors. If you guys want to discuss some of the recent transactions to the Warriors, I'm very happy and thrilled to discuss that, as well as the last 2 years of championships. And a fun fact about me, Starbucks, I love Starbucks, don't hate. I know there's better coffee here, but not so much about the coffee, but I actually, an interesting thing you can do at Starbucks that I encourage all of you to do is not use your real name. I go by Pierre at Starbucks. It's really fun. I one time went by Batman. That was really fun. So I encourage you at Starbucks, you can really be whoever you want to be. So without further ado, let's just jump in. So before I really get into like product management and enterprise product management, I want to take some time to really try and define what is enterprise. Enterprise is a term that we hear all the time. We hear it in different contexts. And really, you know, I want to go through a couple misconceptions, because I think when people think of enterprise, they have this idea in their head. And really, you know, working at both Microsoft and Checker, I've gotten a chance to see how the term can be different based on the company you're working at. So a couple myths, you know, enterprise got to be big. You know, you see this loaf of bread, it's big, big companies, big as enterprise. And while that can be true, it really, you know, it depends. It really is relative to the company you're at. For a company that's just starting out, their first customer, if they're selling, you know, a business-to-business product, that company could be considered enterprise for them. Because really what ends up happening is, as your company is scaling, the customers you attract is really what defines you at that current stage. So, you know, your first customer, your first five customers, they're all going to be enterprise for you. They're all going to be really important, and you want to really delight them and give them a good experience. As you go down the line, and something that I've seen at Checker is those first few customers, you know, obviously we care about all of our customers, but when you have customers in the hundreds and thousands, you don't have time to spend on each individual customer. And then that's really where you try and segment and say, you know, these guys are bigger, but they don't bring in as much value, or they don't bring in as much revenue. And so the definition of enterprise changes over time as your company scales and grows. Another myth is that the company should be recognizable. We obviously know a lot of brand names like the Starbucks and Warriors that I showed. But again, as a company starts out and is just getting product market fit, your first customer might be someone that no one really knows, or it could be like a local local company or company local to your market. In the case of Checker, their first customer was actually the company that the founders originally worked at. So the founders worked at a delivery startup called Deliv. They were their very first customer. And so you can imagine, you know, they were going to do whatever they can to make that one customer happy. And in that moment, you know, you could consider that customer to be enterprise. Now, obviously, things have changed, and there's a lot of different customers with different sizes and value. But, you know, you don't have to be a recognizable brand name to be an enterprise customer for a company. And, you know, I really threw this in there because at least when I started, you know, I had the sense, or I was getting the sense, that when people said enterprise, it was sort of like this unspoken term where, oh, you just kind of got to know. Like, when I name a company, you should know whether it's enterprise or not. And that's really not the case. You know, through these examples, I wanted to illustrate really that there's no obvious definition. It's all relative. It's relative to different factors. Like, what does this company bring you in terms of press and publicity? How much money are they bringing into you? How much value do they bring relative to how big you are as a company? All these factors kind of play into what an enterprise really is. And so really, when we think about what an enterprise customer is, you know, going through a couple examples, more obvious ones, you know, Walmart is the biggest employer in the United States. It's a pretty well-known brand name, both here and across the world. And so this is an example of someone that is just so big, you know, everyone kind of knows them. You know, when we talk about brands, think about something like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is a brand that is known, again, worldwide. But using these examples and going off of what I was talking about earlier, you know, when Checker was, you know, early on in its, you know, life cycle, we were able to work with Uber. And early on for Uber, and it's hard to imagine now, but Uber was not a well-known name. They were kind of like this interesting taxi ordering service. And the reason Checker succeeded was because we were able to identify that Uber was going to be one of those companies that would grow as time goes on. So our competitors in the background check space said, you know, we don't really care about this taxi company that's driving people out of SF. So we're going to stick with the big guns of Walmart and Coca-Cola. Now, what is happening is there's a shift in the industry, in the background check space, and in general in the industry, to try and identify these companies that are on sort of a bigger growth track, where at the beginning, you know, you look at them and you think about them and you're like, ah, you know, they're not going to be anything of value. Like, I'm just going to keep going after the Walmarts and Coca-Colas. But in reality, what's not enterprise today can be enterprise tomorrow. And so that's really what I want to emphasize, is like, again, thinking about where you are as a company, it is very relative, and you have to be able to assess and have the foresight to understand, okay, this company might not seem like a big deal now, but imagine if we stick with them and they grow, we grow as well. So we've kind of defined enterprise. So now I wanted to go into, okay, what actually is enterprise product management? And so I did what a lot of people I think would do in this situation. I Googled it. And so when you Google enterprise product management, you get this very interesting definition that says it's a organizational lifecycle function, blah, 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 marketing a product. And then I threw in at the end because it didn't really say enterprise, it's for the enterprise. And so you look at that definition and you're kind of just like, well, what does that mean? Again, the reality is it's not so easily defined. You can be an enterprise PM and work on internal tools, or you could be an enterprise PM serving the world's biggest customers at the biggest scale. And so really, if you want to try and define enterprise PM, like I tried to draw on some of my experience, and some of the things that I came across in my career were that as an enterprise PM, you work with stakeholders, obviously, sales, customer success, but they can both be internal and external, and you really support their business needs. And this is a key aspect that I want to highlight. It's not, you know, supporting, you know, something that, you know, is fun for them or something that's like makes them, you know, just happy. It's something that actually they perceive as critical to their business, whether it's background checks, whether it's HR software, whether it's the food that they eat. And so you figure out what those defined needs are, what those business needs are, and then you iterate and innovate on those needs as an enterprise PM. So some examples of enterprise B2B companies, and some of these will be fairly obvious for you. Amazon. So Amazon is very interesting because it started out as a consumer company. We all probably ordered from Amazon, but they have a huge enterprise product in the AWS service, the, you know, servers that they sell to other companies. Zenefits, another, you know, name that you guys might have heard of, they sell HR software to other businesses. And what's interesting with Zenefits is they support a lot of really small businesses. And they really, you know, work to support not just the big enterprises, which obviously everyone wants to go after, but, you know, really small companies who have like maybe one or two people who need to run HR software. Checker, obviously, I'm going to be shamelessly plugging my company a lot at this talk, but we're an enterprise B2B company. We sell background checks, which is a critical function to a lot of companies. Finally, I wanted to throw in ZeroCater. So again, when you think of enterprise, when you think of product management, you know, your mind will kind of just go to tech and technology, which, you know, makes sense. We're in a technology-oriented space. But I want to identify that a company like ZeroCater is business critical. It delivers food. Like, you know, you need food to live. So really, when you think of enterprise product management, it really spans the gamut of services that you offer from, again, things that are critical to, like, supporting engineering, to HR, to food and water. So enterprise and enterprise PMs can really be anywhere. So now I wanted to showcase sort of like a comparison of the two, of enterprise versus consumer. So starting off with enterprise, one really, you know, unique and great part of the enterprise product space is you do have the ability to cohort customers to capture requirements. And what I mean by that is if you have 1,000 customers, you don't have to interview all 1,000 customers to figure out what you should build to support all of them. You can actually cohort them by various segments, whether it's, you know, business size, revenue, or industry, such as, you know, retail, financial services, technology. You can use those cohorts to further identify, like, okay, these 5 big retail customers have all asked us to build this feature. I think it makes sense for us strategically, and maybe I should interview one customer from other cohorts to see if it makes sense. You have that ability in the enterprise to really segment your customers, which allows you to get feedback from a few key ones to help identify your roadmap for the future. The other very interesting aspect that I've learned in enterprise is at the end of the day, there's usually one person that's making the decision to buy or not to buy. So imagine, you know, there's positives and negatives. You can imagine your sales team or your product team has done a great job, has like schmoozed, you know, the CS person, the customer success person who's going to use the product, or an engineer who's going to use your analytics platform. And they are on the call and they're like, yeah, this is super exciting. I love this. They take it to their manager or they take it to the person who's writing the check. And the person's like, no, I don't want this. So you can imagine how challenging it is in the enterprise space or how, you know, rewarding it is when you convince that one person to buy your product. Because on the flip side, it works the same way. You might not have to convince all 100 engineers that your version control system is the best. You might only have to convince the VP of engineering, and he says, you know what, we're buying this and you guys are all using this. And so that really influences both, obviously, your frontline sales strategy, but also your product strategy. Because if you kind of understand a person's background or what they're looking for, if they recently joined a company and are looking to make a splash in terms of cutting costs or improving operational efficiency, you can tailor the product to that specific person. Because at the end of the day, if it's one person making the decision, as long as they say yes, it doesn't really matter if the rest of people say no. Now, obviously, you want everyone to be delighted with their product, but when it comes to a decision-making process, that can really help you narrow your focus. This one is obviously probably more of a negative. So in product management, you guys have probably heard of the term roadmaps and one-year roadmaps and planning. So one thing that I've learned is you can have an awesome 3-month, 6-month, 1-year roadmap. But if you have these key marquee customers that are really driving your business forward or were some of your early adopters and know, and the key thing is they know how much value that they bring to you. They can come in at some point or at any point and be like, you know what, we need this or we're leaving you. And when that happens, that really kind of changes the focus. You know, depending on how valuable these customers are, they can either alter the roadmap where you kind of say, okay, we were gonna work on this feature 6 months from now, but we'll slot it in as part of our feature set. Or I've been in situations where my quarterly plan was completely demolished. It was really like, hey, this big customer came in and told the VP or escalated to the CEO and said, if you don't do these 3 things, like, we're out of here. And when that happens, you kind of just have to react, you know, as a product and engineering team and be like, well, if that's really the case, given the amount of value that they bring, we're going to have to do what they want. Now, the learning from that is ideally you work really collaboratively with your sales, CS, and marketing team to get ahead of these sort of fires, to get really a sense of health. You should always know, just like, you know, you should always know how healthy your body is and your mind is, you should know how healthy your customers are. Because before they go from green to red, they have to go to yellow. And so when they're in the yellow phase, you kind of figure out, okay, why are they happy and now they're unhappy? Let's kind of figure that out and make sure we don't get into these situations where we're just destroying, you know, our 1-year plan. Now on the consumer side, if you think about some of these big consumer apps that people use, you know, Snapchat, Robinhood, Instagram, Facebook, etc., really, and you know, this is not black and white, but in general, consumer is about new versus redefining old. If you think about how Snapchat created a new way to share photos and images and life events, that was something new. It didn't really exist before. If you think about Robinhood, the way it incorporated free stock trading, and it was completely on mobile, there wasn't really a desktop version, that was new versus the old method of trading stocks. And the reason behind that is, you know, with consumer, the growth potential is nearly unlimited. With enterprise, if you really think about it, there is a fixed set of companies you can sell to. You know, there's the Fortune 500, and then maybe there's hundreds of other businesses. But in enterprise, it's more about beating an existing product, like building a new background check or building a better catering service or a new server hosting service. And so you're constantly in competition with existing players in the industry to steal market share from the other people. Whereas, you know, everyone here, if I came out with the best, cookie making app thing, you might not have to move away from how you used to buy and eat cookies. You could all download the app, and I could reach a user base, you know, that's in the hundreds of thousands, millions, or in the case of Facebook, billions. The downside, however, to consumer is sometimes the monetization model is not obvious. So if you think of enterprise, it's like, I'm selling you this product. I'm probably going to sell it to you, you know, maybe at $1 per user per month or per background check or per food item. The monetization is fairly obvious in most cases. However, in consumer, it's not obvious because let's say when Facebook was starting out, you had to put in your credit card to sign up. A lot of people might not have signed up and the app probably wouldn't have seen the growth it did today. So it really takes a long time to develop a monetization model for consumer where you still get the user growth, but you obviously still get money. And so that's really some of the challenges for the consumer space where you know, it's not really obvious. And so you have to figure out a way to build an app that gets money but doesn't, you know, kill your users. But the main thing I want to emphasize is that the center and intersection of both of these is a happy user, happy customer. You know, obviously as a PM, this goes without saying, but you want your customers to be happy. In the consumer space, that's the users of your app or your service. In the enterprise space, it's not only the person that decided to buy your product, but it's also the people who are actually, you know, on the front line who are using your product every day. The VP might have been the one who was impressed by the flashy presentation and the, you know, amount of money that they could save, but it's really the, you know, support representative or the sales development representative who might be using your product every day. And if they're not happy, eventually the news is going to spread up to the person who even made the decision, and they won't hesitate to switch out of your product if their company and their team is not happy. So when we think about the enterprise product lifecycle, it might seem straightforward now. We cohort customers, we figure out common themes. Let's just, you know, go ahead and build. In reality, it's not like that. So when you think about the MVP or the minimum viable product, you can't start with something like you see in the top image there. If the thing you start with doesn't work fundamentally, you've already lost your potential client. What you have to do in enterprise product management is you have to start with something that's already working. It's already good and it already fulfills the function that the customer is looking to buy, and it just gets better over time. So you think about the background check space, stage one is like, does it obtain criminal records? Stage two might be, does it give you insight into how much you're spending? Stage three might be, does it predict how long it's going to take to return a criminal record? Yeah. That's a great question. So surprisingly or not surprisingly, getting to that initial product market fit is as simple or as complicated as just doing a lot of interviews with a select group of people. So what I mean by that, like I mentioned in one of the earlier slides, when you cohort customers or even, you know, let's say you're just trying to build a product for the enterprise, chances are, you know, it's going to be hard for you to get Walmart or Coca-Cola. But you could probably get someone smaller, like a really small SMB or someone you know who works at this company to say, hey, can you try this out and give me your feedback? The key thing there, though, is when you have the initial product, it should fulfill a very defined set of needs. And when the people are piloting or demoing your product, there should be no ambiguity as to, you know, how do I use this? What does this do? And what value does it bring? And so when you really drill down into those like two or three key things, you can start out, obviously, you know, humble beginnings with very small customers who are open and willing to give feedback because, you know, they might want to take a chance because your product could be the next best thing for their company. And so really, it's about identifying who those companies are that would be open and willing to give you feedback and then really working with them. And what's interesting is when you do that process, they themselves will be excited that you're giving them the time and attention that maybe some of the bigger players are not. Yeah.
And do, I guess, when a company's starting, do they usually get their product for free or like discounted?
Yeah. So a lot of companies, and actually I'm about to go into a case study that talks about this, but in general, there is a concept of a beta phase. A lot of companies will not just launch in the wild, they will be in sort of a stealth beta where they're working with a select few companies to iterate and define based on an initial hypothesis. And once they validated that hypothesis, then they really go wide. So, I mean, that really, well, I have to go through some challenges first, but I'll talk about that in a sec. But really, so some of the challenges you will see in the enterprise space that can be combated by some examples I'll show in just a sec is that customers in the enterprise space will really actually want everything to be fully end-to-end tested and production ready. You know, if you go to a customer, internally, you can be like, hey, this is kind of our beta. It's a work in progress. But if you go to a customer and say, hey, this is a beta, do you want to try this out and then maybe buy it? Chances are they're going to be like, you know, no, I don't really want to talk to you. And again, you know, it's important to approach the customers in the right way. You either figure out, is this a customer who is more amenable to a product that's not fully ready, but fulfills a core function in a really unique and innovative way? Or is this a customer who is open to something that's, you know, maybe broken or has some bugs to fix because they know that there's a chance that it could be something bigger and better than what they're currently using. So this is something to keep in mind. And this is also, you know, as a company scales, this becomes more and more of a challenge where, yes, you have a good product that works for customers 1 through 100, but customers 101 to 1,000, depending on how big they are, will not settle for anything that breaks. I've personally experienced at Checker, we go through pilots a lot. And in the pilot, if you miss a record on an applicant, it's pretty much a done deal. Like, it's not really a matter of, hey, the court was down that day or the researcher was slow or unavailable. They will kind of just take a look at that experience and say, hey, you kind of screwed up in our test. We don't care how much faster or cheaper or better you are. We're going to move on to a competitor. And so that's really the challenge where you have to make things super robust. But the good news is there is when you pass those initial tests, they will sign a contract with you. And unlike a consumer app where you can delete a Facebook app or stop using an app for whatever, generally these contracts have language in them that says you have a minimum dollar amount, there's a minimum length. And even if there are screw-ups, the company has a chance to rectify those before they can just walk away. And so those are kind of the dual sides to getting buy-in for an enterprise product. The other challenge, and two of these I'll kind of talk together, enterprise generally involves switching. You know, you could have a great product, but you're going to have to convince the customer not only to buy it, but to switch all their existing users onto your product. And so it's not just about what's better. It's about what's the switching cost. Do I have to retrain my my team? Do I have to build my own new support function to support the new product because all our support queues are built on the old one. And so these are things that you have to keep in mind as, you know, potential challenges that you have to factor in, not just into building features, but also building training and support.
If you have enjoyed the episode so far, check out our upcoming live events at productschool.com/events. Use the promo code PRODUCTPODCAST in all caps to get a free ticket to the next event in your city.
Now, to address some of your questions, I wanted to talk through a case study of Slack, a company a lot of you might know about. So a little bit about Slack. So again, this is something that I believed for a long time. When I was hearing about Slack, it really felt like it just sort of blew up. So if you guys remember 2012, 2013, a bunch of press came out about this company called Slack. It's this super hot chat app. Everyone's using it. You better use it. You got to get on it. And I was like, wow, like, is this how like companies work? You just release something and it just goes like that. It just goes like a rocket ship. And that's reality. You know, that's not the case. A big thing here, and you know, this is very public research too, which is awesome. Slack did 6 months of user testing and feedback with these beta companies, kind of like I was referencing earlier, where yes, they built this innovative chat app and yes, they sort of, you know, blew up after the fact, but they spent a good 6 months just talking to two or three companies, iterating and defining and understanding what is good about our app, what can be improved, how do we scale this, and how do we move past these smaller companies who are willing to try anything to bigger companies who will not hesitate to switch out of something that doesn't work for them. This feedback phase was critical in how they figured out how to build a generalized chat solution. And, you know, a couple companies they worked with RDO, Cozy, which is a tenant screening platform. You know, again, like I sort of mentioned earlier, the CEO, he got in contact with some of his old connections at these companies and said, hey, why don't you try this out? Can you give me feedback? You know, we'd really appreciate it. It could be something that would be interesting to you. And it was just like that. It was just sort of through connections and networking that they were able to find a very small group of people. It wasn't the entire company, at least at first, to really give them feedback and say, hey, I like this about your product, or I don't like this, and you're going to need to change this if you want me to pay money for this. And so when we think of a rocket ship or rocket ship type companies, it's really counterintuitive. When we think of a rocket ship, we're like, oh yeah, it just sort of exploded and everything just worked. But in reality, especially for enterprise, There's a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes to refine and iterate on a product to the point where it is now, where you know it and you love it. It really took a long time to get there. So if we think about some of the learnings, like I mentioned, it was in beta for over 6 months. When it was released, when the general public heard about it, it had passed all these initial steps by these companies. They were like, hey, this is great. We'll buy this. We'll buy this. And Slack was like, okay, I think we have something big here. The other interesting thing that I alluded to earlier is enterprise products affect teams. So when you sell an enterprise product, it could affect people in all parts of a company's organization. It might not, even though you think it's just, maybe it's just targeted towards engineers or it's targeted towards HR people, it could be that the IT person has to deal with, you know, how to update your software, or the support person has to deal with talking to applicants who don't know what's happening with their background check, even though you sold it to the HR team. And so you have to consider the holistic image of an enterprise product, because when you delight all those users, you have a much better chance of retention and adoption. And like I mentioned again and again, customer feedback is critical. In the beginning, obviously more so, but continuously, because as you get feedback, you'll understand both the health of your customer and also how to improve and power your product. So, okay, we're at this point now. This is easy, right? We know how to cohort customers. We know how to define enterprise. We know how to get feedback. Like, let's do this. Let's just like all build an enterprise product and it's game over. But, you know, if we were to do that, we would end up with a lot of cars like this, where if all we did was interview 3 to 5 customers and say, give me your top 5 features that would make you buy my product. So customer A will say, well, I want the hood of the car to be like a wing style. Customer 2 will be like, well, I want a truck. And customer 3 will be like, well, I want a sports car. And you as a PM, if you're like, well, engineering team, like just build them all together, just fuse them all together, we'll get all these 3 customers and life will be great. But then you'll end up with a car that all 3 customers don't like, and it doesn't really set you up for success. You can also think of, you know, the classic elephant problem, where depending on where you're looking, it seems like it's a different product. And that's the challenge of just, you know, blindly collecting feedback from customers and trying to just iterate it. If you adopt the laundry list mentality with enterprise product management, you'll quickly end up in one of these 2 silos. So how do you avoid that? Obviously, these are terms that you've probably heard, strategy and vision, but it's extremely, extremely important. You know, when you start, yeah, you can accommodate all 5 of the same customer's requests. But as you scale to 5, 10, 100,000 customers, you can't just take everyone's request. You're going to have to say no, and you're going to have to provide strategic value in some way. And customers will actually like that and appreciate that more. If a customer tells you, you know, I want a cookie, and you say, okay, you know what? I don't think you want a cookie. I think you're hungry. So I'm going to give you the tools to bake a cookie. And they'll be like, wow, I didn't even realize I wanted to bake a cookie. I just thought I wanted a cookie. And so obviously that's a trivial example, but customers will appreciate the fact that you're digging more into the insight of what they really want and giving them generalized tools and solutions to through your product to support their needs, not just for today, but for tomorrow and the day after. So you have to have a strategy. And, you know, this is a big cliche in the product management industry. You have to have a North Star. And I have a bunch of North Star images to prove that. But it's really important. If you don't have a North Star, if you don't know where you're going, as the great saying goes, any road will take you. And so customers can take you for a ride anywhere if you don't have a vision that you're willing to stand by. Now, onto a second case study. I'm sure most of you guys anticipated this. I'm going to talk about Checker, the company I work at. So a little bit about Checker. Some of you may have heard of it. We are a background check company. It was founded in 2014. Really, the flagship product that got us our early market adoption was an API. So you can imagine companies like Uber, Lyft, Postmates, Grubhub, they are technology forward. They want their drivers and delivery people to go through an experience that's fully hosted that they think is only on Grubhub or Uber, and that's mobile friendly. And so the founders at Checker realized this revolution was happening in their 2013-2014. And so they built a product that was designed for these tech companies and high volume on-demand companies to really support in their app. And so some of the key differentiators as a result of this technology-enabled solution was turnaround time. The most annoying thing, as for any of you who've gone through the background check process, is when is my background check going to get done? And because of technology solutions that allow us to process results, we were faster than competitors. And by result of being faster, you end up being cheaper because you don't have people that are looking at the results, making sure things are okay. And accuracy is another big part. Using technology to confirm that your record was indeed the accurate one from 2012 or 2011 that said this charge from this county, that's a huge piece. So really what I want to illustrate in this study, other than shamelessly plugging the company I work for, is how to understand customer needs. You know, thinking back to a deeper example beyond selling cookies, we had a challenge a couple of years back where customers would ask us, we would ask customers like, hey, what are your pain points in the background check process? Or HR person, what's your biggest problem? And they would say things like, it's great. Your solution's great. You have technology. But it's kind of annoying. You know, every day I spend 2 hours a day looking at these reports. And I don't care about vehicle. I don't care about that the guy ran a red light, or I don't care that he smoked weed 2 years ago. But I still have to look at the reports because it could be that it was a murder charge, or it could be theft or something that I'm seriously caring about. And so the team sort of processed this for a while. And suddenly, I would like to say it was me, but it wasn't me. Someone came to the conclusion that the biggest pain point that customers were having were that they were looking at reports that they don't care about. There were charges that they were totally fine if we didn't even show them at all. Like, even if the court gave it back to us, we could hide them. And so through that discovery process, through talking to customers and drilling deep into what the underlying pain is, we came across a product that we call PAM, not PAM from the office, but the Positive Adjudication Matrix. And what this product does is it lumps charges into a set of aggregate buckets. So you can imagine theft, drugs, gambling, animal ordinances. We figured out the key classifications that customers cared about that the courts were bucketing for us almost. And we presented this to customers and said, okay, look, we know you don't care about people fishing illegally, or we know you don't care about people having their dog off leash, which is a charge in some counties in the US. So we will give you this tool that allows you to just hide all of these charges. And so your HR team can spend less time looking at these charges and more time looking at things that they care about. And so this is an example of where, you know, no customer is going to tell you, oh, I want a positive adjudication matrix, or, oh, I want to order a car, for my company. It really comes down to a lot of in-person feedback and interviews where you synthesize the pain points and then you think about, okay, instead of giving each of them a cookie, or instead of giving each of them a faster way to look at these charges, how do I give them the tools to improve their process? And, you know, getting this feedback is not that complicated. Obviously, the best way is direct in-person interviews. And again, cohorting your customers will help you solve this faster. You don't need to interview 1,000 customers. You can interview 3 to 5 and get that feedback. You can also observe customers using the product. This is very informative and sometimes very sad and frustrating, but it's really good because when you see a customer, you know, clicking and scrolling and refreshing, you're like, ah, damn, you know, I kind of screwed this up. We should probably figure out a way to, you know, improve the usage of this product. Also, your customer-facing teams are your best insight into how customers are feeling. They talk to customers, whether it's sales, customer success, marketing, business development. They talk to these customers every day. And so you can imagine as these relationships develop, the customers will not, you know, it's not even like they're saying, give me feedback. The, you know, a CS person or a salesperson is not on a call saying, hey, it's Monday at 9 a.m., give me feedback. It'll really be informally, the customer will say, man, you know, today I had this experience with your product. It'd be really cool if it did this, but let's move on. And so they are actually holding a lot of information that you might not know about, but would be really interesting for you as a product manager to understand and synthesize, because it could help you improve the way your product functions. And number four, you know, just take your best guess and assume. Not really. You should never really assume or guess anything. You should have hypotheses, but you should use the results of the top three and, you know, other ways of collecting customer feedback to validate the hypotheses that you have, to validate that, oh, you know, I think customers want a way to adjudicate records easily, or I think customers want a cookie recipe. And so that's really where you use the tools at your disposal to learn from customers. So now I wanted to talk a little bit about what being an enterprise PM is like. And so since I've had the luxury of working at both a big and a small company, I wanted to go through some key examples. So big buy-in. So buy-in is obviously, you get support from a set of people. That's really the name of the game when it comes to product features. So let's say you have an amazing idea and you're like, this is going to give our company $1 billion. It doesn't matter, to be perfectly honest, if you can't convince the key stakeholders that are probably several levels higher than you to say, you know what? Yes, I like this idea. The other director likes this idea. The other VP of marketing likes this idea. All right, all 10 of us like this idea. Now we're going to do it. And that's really the name of the game at big companies. The reason behind this is at big established companies, they have customers who cannot be pissed off. If a big company is selling a product to a big enterprise customer, any small change that could cause, workflow disruption could risk them leaving you. And so for the VPs and the executives who are making these calls, they're not going to take any risk without the buy-in of everyone else, because it's, at the end of the day, it's their ass on the line if something goes wrong. And because of this, a lot of the key product and strategic decisions are top-down. So you can imagine, let's say you're the one who has to decide the big flagship product that's going to really push you guys as a company forward. That's an obviously great and awesome responsibility, but are you ready for that responsibility affecting all the customers? Chances are you might not even have the context to make those kind of decisions. So it's really on the executives to say, you know what, we're going in this strategic direction and, people below me, get in line. Or hopefully they'll say, these are the reasons why I think this is the right strategic move. So decisions are made mostly top down. Release schedules, so they vary. And by vary, I mean they could be as fast as weeks, or in the case of Microsoft, when you're releasing Windows OS software, 6 months. So it really depends. It really depends how, open the customer or the company is to releasing something that could break a lot of customers' workflows. Because most companies are not comfortable with breaking any major customers' workflows, they're going to go through a period of just pure testing and integration testing and things like that. Because, they want to make sure every possible variance is tested before they release something out. Now, at a small company, at least in the beginning, as you can imagine, it's more about releasing. It's more about releasing so fast that by the time you've thought about your last release, the other release is already out. And that's really exciting. It's really cool to just push a button and see something go live and see customers use it. Decision-wise, the people on the ground, the front line, actually have more visibility into how the customer is feeling than the leadership. So a lot of it is actually more bottom-up, and PMs have huge amounts of influence at some of the smaller companies because they're the ones talking to all the cross-functional stakeholders, and they're the ones reporting up to leadership like, hey, a lot of customers are having pain points with how they view criminal records. I think we should build this adjudication product. And the leadership will really synthesize those inputs and say, yes, go here, or no, don't do that. And especially at the beginning, as a company grows, it's hard for this to happen, but small companies are really open to different ideas from anyone. You don't have to be a PM or even on the greater product and engineering org to suggest a great idea. I've seen great ideas come from pretty much everyone in the organization because different people have different specialties, and obviously just because you're a PM or engineer, you probably don't have the most interaction with the customer. It's probably coming from a different part of the org. So at Microsoft, to go into a little more detail, I was working in the Windows developer platform. We had a 6-month release cycle. As you can imagine, that wasn't that fun. There was 3 months where you built new features and 3 months where you tested. And the idea was in the testing phase, PMs would be prepping for the upcoming build phase. Massive amounts of testing. So because of all this, because of the release cycle, because they were not willing to risk losing existing customers, roadmaps are actually planned out to a T about 1 to 2 years in advance in some cases. And so the benefit there is when that roadmap is locked in, you have 6-month release cycles of, you know, OS or server software that's going out to the world. And so any variation in that release cycle is going to screw up everything. So as a PM, you can feel comfortable knowing that, okay, if my project has made it on the roadmap, it's going to happen and nothing is going to disrupt it. But the downside is if you don't make it on, or, you know, the flagship product or feature that you want to release is only going to come in 2 years, you're kind of just figuring out, okay, well, what do I do in the meantime? So at Checker, at a small startup, you know, I wasn't siloed to one team. I wasn't really attached. Obviously, as a PM, I work with engineers, but I worked across pretty much every team. And that's just a function of being at a small, fast-paced startup. You can see, you know, just like, you know, you can see a child grow up and it's really exciting. You can see a company rapidly grow and rapidly expand customers and, you know, company size. And with that rapid expansion, you see product decisions change quarter to quarter. So you can imagine towards the end of the quarter, and we just did this planning process, you as a PM gather with your stakeholders, whether it's in sales, CS, marketing, finance, et cetera, and you talk to them, okay, what are your needs? What are your pain points? Again, just like when talking to customers, you'll likely get a laundry list. You'll likely get, okay, I want this button moved here. I want this dashboard changed here. And I want XYZ feature done now. And it's really on you as a PM to hang back and think of that strategic vision and value to say like, okay, I know you gave me 10 features, but really if I deliver you these 2 or 3 things, it's going to address all your needs now and in the future. And so that's really where the product decisions, even though they're changing and it's, you know, fast and crazy, you have to sort of keep it reeled in and explain to your stakeholders how it's going to work. To give us some more insight into how the product process evolved over time. So in the beginning, the roadmaps were all customer driven. A few key customers, which represented various customers in different industries, would sort of dictate like, hey, you know, you guys are kind of missing these features and you really need them to achieve parity. Every project, like I said, is subject to change. So you can imagine you're working on a project or feature for customer XYZ, but the deal fell through. So now you're working on project ABC. And so it really is really fast and fluid because, you know, a lot of customers will express interest or seem like they are going to sign a deal with you. And then suddenly they say, you know what? We're not looking to change our background check vendor. We're not looking to change our catering vendor right now. And so you have to be able to adapt and say, okay, one, was the feature I was originally building going to help other customers? If the answer is no, then the next feature you work on better, you know, work with other customers that you're working with. At least in the beginning, when you're trying to build a company, when you're trying to build revenue, the deal size, the amount of dollars that are bringing in is the highest priority. So obviously we would love if every customer just wanted chocolate chip cookies. So we could just build a factory of chocolate chip cookies and grow to be the biggest chocolate chip cookie company in the world. But one customer who's like, hey, I'm going to pay you $1 billion to make cupcakes. Guess what? You're making cupcakes. You know, the deal size at the beginning is given highest priority. But again, as a PM, it's up to you to say, okay, instead of making a cookie cutting machine, I'm going to make, you know, a generalized dough machine where the dough can turn into cookies or cupcakes. And so obviously, you know, I love cookies and cupcakes and those analogies, but it's really on you as the PM to figure out, okay, when you're in these harrowing situations, how do I, you know, stay back and think strategically about how I can, you know, affect not just this customer, but future customers. Today, you know, it's been 3 to 4 years in Checker's history. We do have time. We do have the space to incorporate strategic projects. So projects that not any one customer is really asking for, but we know is going to give us strategic value. An example of this project that I worked on early on was the analytics project. We wanted to build an analytics dashboard, and we weren't going to charge for it, but we knew it would give us strategic value to our customers because they would like to see how many background checks have I run in the month. How many people, you know, have I, you know, not hired because of criminal backgrounds? You know, these sort of analytics were something that we knew customers would want. And so we did a vetting process. We did interviews. We did research sessions and we built out an MVP. Yeah.
So did you include the analytics dashboard in your MVP? Like in,
No. So, again, like, because this was something that we only came across after we felt comfortable with our, you know, customer base and felt some stability, like analytics was seen as an add-on. And so what changes over time is things that might be considered add-ons will then become strategic projects, and strategic projects might become must-haves. But again, it's all relative to the time. In the beginning, we just wanted to make sure we got criminal records and sent it to the right person. But as time goes on, we're like, you know what? We're comfortable giving and showing criminal records. Let's show some analytics. Or, you know, we're comfortable showing analytics and showing criminal records. Let's build this complicated adjudication matrix to support our customer needs. Yeah.
Do you think in this like time, 2018, like analytics is sort of part of MVP now, or does that depend on the product?
It really depends, to be perfectly honest. Like, you know, obviously Checker is one example. Background checks, when you sell to a company and they're like, okay, we want a background check, they're not saying we want county criminal searches, we want driver searches, we also want analytics. That generally didn't happen, at least very early on. Now some things have changed, but you can imagine taking another analog like ZeroCater. Companies are going to be like, are you going to give me my food? Are you going to give it to me on time? Or is it going to taste good? They're not going to be like, are you also going to give me an analytics dashboard of how much sugar or how much salt my employees are eating? It's really about figuring out what the core feature set is, delivering delight and excellence on that. And then when the customer is happy and comfortable with your product, it's like, okay, now we're going to give you analytics, or now we're going to give you insights or metrics. And what's interesting is that conversation will come up over time. Over time, when companies are using your products for years, most of them will naturally say, like, you know what, I kind of want to know how much I'm spending or how much, you know, pizza I've been ordering from you. And then you'll be like, well, yeah, we'll show you the analytics. Now, today, the value of the customer is considered, but it's not absolute. So what I mean by that is customers who were considered like must-have, we need them, we'll do anything for them, we'll die without them. Now what I've seen is those definitions have changed over time. We obviously have those same set of customers today where we're like, hey, for you guys, for you 5 or 10 or 15, we'll do, you know, mostly what you ask. But the companies of yesterday where we were like, we'll do anything, now we're like, hey, you know, we're not really going to do everything we want that you want us to do. We'll do some things, but if you really want us to do this and you threaten, you know, we're going to leave, go ahead and leave. We have other customers that support our business and really support us strategically, and we're going to align ourselves with them. The other really awesome part that I'm very happy we've gotten to as a company is there's time set aside for discovery versus implementation. So at a fast-paced startup, you really don't have time to fully dig in or fully discover what the right thing to build is. You have a set of hypotheses. You'll have, you know, some time, maybe a couple weeks or a month at max to really vet out that hypothesis, but you got to build. Because if you're deep in a sales cycle and the salesperson is telling you, you know, we need to close this deal, or in more often cases, at times I've seen a salesperson say, hey, we've already told them that we've built this, so can you build it? You really don't have time to discover what exactly it is that you need to build. You're going to have to do it simultaneously. And that, while exciting, is often frustrating and challenging at times. Now, it's very clear we have some tracks where PMs have time to really discover what to build. And then however long that process takes, whether it's a week, a month, a quarter, then you set aside time to implement. And while implementing, you can implement, you know, agile, iterative. You implement small pieces at a time. You build a skateboard, then the scooter, then the car. But it's important to know that there is time to have that discovery process. So as a day-to-day, to kind of, you know, sum things up, obviously as a PM, I have a lot of meetings. There's time set aside for spec writing. A lot of feedback session with engineering who's actually building the product. We have sprint planning and reviews. And then finally, you have extra time devoted to quarter long-term planning. And this last part is really important. Thinking back, you know, through the presentation, cohorting your customers, building a laundry list, those things are fine, but without the planning to thinking about what you want to do long-term, what your vision is, what the company's vision and mission is, those are really the differentiators that will set you apart as an enterprise product manager. So obviously I covered a lot here. So I really just wanted to go over some key takeaways. A lot of customer interactions, surprise, surprise. I mean, if there's one thing you do and do well, synthesize customer feedback and know the right questions to ask. It's interesting. I've been in customer meetings where I've literally asked them point blank, what do you not like? Or what do you think about our product? And they'll be like, yeah, things are okay. But then when you observe them using the product, or when you ask, hey, I noticed, you know, you were clicking around a lot in this feedback session. Do you know why? And they're like, yeah, well, your dashboard kind of scrolls weird, but I'm used to it now. And so it's really going beyond just asking people point blank, like, what's wrong? It's really observing and understanding. You have to use the feedback and make it drive enhancements and products and workflows. It's not just about, you know, building that grouped car. It's about figuring out, okay, what exactly do you want? And then, like I mentioned before, observation will give you the ultimate, you know, understanding of customer need for product innovation. Also, GIFs make presentations a lot better. In case you guys are planning to give presentations, I recommend using GIFs. Checker has a great Giphy culture, so I learned it from there. So yeah, that was the presentation. That felt long. I don't know how for you it felt long for me, but hopefully you guys got something out of it. Again, you know, feel free to connect with me. A lot of salespeople have guessed my email, so I figure there's no point in trying to hide it. It's just anand@checker.com. So feel free to email me or connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to discuss anything offline that you might have. Thank you. Question. Yeah, so the question was, what was the transition like from Microsoft to Checker? So I was reached out to by my current manager, the director of product, and really the transition was more about taking the existing PM skills that I learned at a big company at Microsoft with a lot of structure and applying it to an area where, yes, you do need traditional PM skills, but you need to do everything just way faster and at scale. So the transition was more about, you know, can you go from, you know, a methodical, structured environment to one where sometimes you don't know exactly what you need to do or who to talk to? And can you figure out how to thrive in those situations? And really, I would say the foundation that the big companies give you prepare you really well for the startups. Because, you know, people know, you know, if you're coming from a big company, they'll know you're trying to figure things out. And it's more about, can you do the core part of your job correctly? And then people will help you, you know, if you need to talk to customers or meet with people. Yes?
Sometimes PMs also, like, manage the engineers as well. Is that something that you do, or do you have an engineering counterpart that you work with?
Yeah. So the question was, do PMs manage engineers? Personally, I've actually never really seen that. I know the title product manager is sort of up in the air on management, but in general, for me and from what I've seen, PMs work with engineering managers to help align the team on what to build. So that's, you know, mostly what I've seen. Yep.
Did the two founders of Checker, did they leave first and then make the Checker?
Yes. So they were working at a delivery startup. What had happened was their manager said, hey, figure out this background check thing. It's kind of complicated. And they were starting to work on it. They were like, oh man, this is like a serious problem. So they immediately, I think they left or transitioned out. And then they went back to their company and said, hey, we figured out your background check thing, but we're kind of doing our own thing now. So it really worked out for them. So yeah, it's interesting. I would say industry experience gives you insight into the pains that, you know, both you and other people might be feeling. And so, you know, nothing really beats that, because once you understand the pain point, obviously, you know, you can, they could have tried to solve it just for them, or you could figure out, you know, this is something that could change the industry and you can leave and, you know, kind of do your own thing.
Do you think it's possible to stay and then do it?
Yes, but so the challenge is, if you stay, the company can technically own the, so imagine if they built this amazing API within Deliv. It would only be owned by Deliv. And, you know, the downside is not just, you know, yeah, obviously it's great to build your own company and raise funding and make a lot of money. But if one company owns the proprietary software, other companies can't use it. And so, you know, technology like this can really change industries. And so it is beneficial to sometimes take a risk and leave to build something that can be used generally.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, I was curious, how much can you learn just from looking at like usage analytics versus having to actually talk to customers?
So to be honest, broad spectrum analytics will only help you diagnose like where the problem is happening. Unless you talk to a customer, you're really not going to know. Like, imagine someone says, my body's hurting. And you're like, okay, well, that, maybe you have analytics that says 100% of your users have body pains. But the body is big, right? You need to talk to a few to say, oh, my head is hurting. Three people are like, my head is hurting too. And they're like, oh, I see. So obviously that's kind of a weird example and I'm running out of analogies, but the reality is, you know, analytics paint a broad picture. Customer insight will really take you far and beyond. You know, I'm constantly learning more and more things about how customers use our product just from talking to them. And, you know, sometimes it works in your favor. You know, sometimes I've gone into meetings or presentations where I'm like, this part of our product is screwed up and I'm going to figure out why. And I ask them like, hey, you know, is there anything they can improve? And they're like, well, you know, your product's actually really good in this aspect. And I'm like, oh, great. So my job is done. So it can work for you both ways. It doesn't always have to be negative or feedback to change. Yes?
So you were talking a lot about how it used to be when it all started and how it is now, and the difference between constant customization for specific customers and being a real SaaS product. So the baseline is just having more customers and more revenue. That's when you define, okay, I'll stop doing constant customization and I'll think about my own roadmap.
I would say, yeah, so I wouldn't say there's like a specific number to hit of customers or revenue. It's more about stability. So if you have 100 customers that are using you one day, don't use the next day, use you the next day, it's really inconsistent, even though you've hit a number. Or, you know, maybe you're earning $1 million, but that number just keeps changing because, you know, you don't know how the customers are using. 5 key customers that really love you and really like your product could be the foundation that you build off of. Because if you built a product that 3 to 5 or 10, like a pick a number that's small, if they really love your product and really, you know, want to use it and continue to use it, you will find other customers that feel that same level of delight. It's actually hard, in my opinion, to build such a niche product that, you know, it's so niche that only 2 people love it and everyone else hates it. That's generally pretty hard, especially in the enterprise industry. So if you really latch onto something that a few people love, in the case of Slack, only 3 people loved it at the start. And now, you know, obviously a lot of people use it. Yes?
Have you come across a situation where you build something for a larger customer and the smaller customer players said that they don't really like that feature?
Yeah. So the question was, has anything been built that a large customer likes that a small customer doesn't like? Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of like a specific example, and especially ones that projects that I can talk about. I mean, that's definitely the case. You know, if you think about what a large customer, I'll give a rough example. You know, let's say there's a large customer who has, you know, franchises or, you know, different locations, offices throughout the country. Maybe they want each of their, you know, locations to get a copy of the invoice or how much background checks they've run. So imagine, you know, you're emailing out 1,000 people, and for that big customer, that's what they want. They want every person, every man, GM, to get a copy of the invoice. But if you imagine your small customers, let's say that they have, you know, 5 people, they only have 5 offices spread across the country, but they have 1 head of accounting or head of finance. They might say, hey, why are you sending us 5 copies of this? Our GM or our head of finance is the one who's looking at all of them anyway. We'll be like, well, you know, unfortunately, our product is configured when you have et cetera amount of customers to split it like that. So it's very possible in that scenario. Again, you have to think about the trade-offs. It's like, do you want to offer both functionality and support both as your small SMB customer base increases or your enterprise base increases? Or do you want to say, hey, you know, at this point, it's my way or the highway. Like, you can figure out how you want to use this, or because we have bigger customers who are interested. So it's really about the trade-offs and, again, thinking about where you want to go strategically. If you know where you want to go strategically, the answer will kind of figure out itself.
Thank you.
Yep.
You spoke about Northstar a couple of times. Is it more like to be able to portray the value of your product and in enterprise setup?
Yeah, so when I mean North Star, I mean like, let's say you're, you know, a baking company, or let's say you start out as a cookie company, cupcake customer says, I'll pay you a billing for cupcakes, now you're a cupcake company. If your leadership and your company is aligned, like our North Star is a baking company, it doesn't matter if a huge customer comes in and says, we want you to make pizzas and we'll pay you $1 trillion. Your North Star says, you know what, yes, the money is valuable, but now we're spread so thin, we don't know who we are as a company. We don't have an identity. So the North Star is really about, okay, what vision can we buy into that will hold for the, you know, like, you know, infinite in time. Yeah, for the long term. Yeah. And so that's why, you know, and that's why it's cliche, but that's why companies come out with vision statements so early on. Because if you wait to come out with a vision statement, you'll just be like a restaurant that serves all cuisines and you serve all of them badly. And so, you know, that's really where the North Star really comes into play. Yep.
So, curious, when you sell to the enterprise customers, how do you, I guess, how do you open the first couple doors when you don't have a lot of capability or finance? As a PM, what's your interaction with the customer?
So, early on, I will say it's, I mean, obviously sales is a very challenging job. From what I understand, at least early on, you have to have a strong network. It's very unlikely, or you got to be lucky for someone to discover your product. And so obviously, you know, you guys will see this in terms of marketing. For consumer products, it's a lot about marketing and Facebook ads and Google AdWords and stuff. But for the enterprise, it's like, hey, you know, I met you at the product school event, and now you're working at this company that I want to sell to. You want to try out my products, you know, it would be really helpful for me to get feedback. And then, you know, you leverage your internal network to really get your existing customer base. And then, you know, over time, if people are really delighted with your product, it will gain traction overall. Like Slack, as a good example, you know, it started out slow and then it really kind of went like this. The other advantage that I forgot to mention in the presentation was with enterprise products, a common strategy is land and expand. So what I mean by that is you don't, you know, if you're selling background checks, you say, hey, you know what? Don't give us all your volume. Give us like all your volume in Phoenix or in Kansas. And we'll prove to you that we're better than your incumbent or your vendor in Kansas right now. And so when you give them that option, you say, hey, and we'll give it for free. We'll be like, we'll do all your background checks for free for Kansas for a week, and we will beat your competition. And if you do prove it, if you don't prove it, you're out. But if you do prove it, then they'll be like, okay, we're going to give you Texas now. We're going to give you New York. Now we're going to give you the nation. Now we're going to give you the globe. And so land and expand is a great strategy that enterprises often employ that mitigates the risk for both sides, where, you know, obviously if you're doing a pilot with the customer, it's all hands on deck. You'd be like, hey, make sure everything's working. Make sure everything's polished, because if we land this, we'll get a bigger piece of their business and bigger one. Yep.
In your backlog, do you include any maintenance stuff in those things, or is there engineering?
Yeah, so maintenance obviously will come up. Generally, what we try and do with maintenance is, you know, bugs obviously get triaged based on priority. If things are critically breaking customer workflows, we will address it ASAP. Other ones, you know, it's very important to distinguish between a bug and like a feature and a feature request. So bugs, if they're not critical or, you know, breaking customers, you know, workflows, you can assess them relative to the other features in your backlog. Feature requests are obviously prioritized and triaged with all other feature requests. So it's important to know, a great thing my manager told me was, just because you're busy trying to figure out what to build doesn't mean you just throw bugs at the engineering team because, you know, they need something to do. You should try and find a balance where bugs and tech debt are more done out of necessity and, you know, because you're doing the discovery process, not because you're swamped as a PM and you're like, man, all these guys want some work to do. Let me just give them all these bugs. And so that's really, you know, the balance that you have to figure out, you know, how to do as a PM.
Thanks for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. If you want to know more about our courses and next course, visit productschool.com. Stay tuned for the next episode to learn more about the secrets in product management.